This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 9th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Happy Easter and happy Passover and happy Ramadan too. Welcome to edition number 285. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the big deal feature, Jim Mullen joins me for the view from Bowen Island, the end of Simon Fraser University football, and what's next for the new public park on Bowen Island. But first, is it just me? Is it just me, or is peace really possible? You bet it is, and the time to talk about it is Easter weekend, this Easter weekend. It was 25 years ago on April 10th, 1998, that the Good Friday Agreement between the Irish Republic and United Kingdom signaled an end to the Troubles. The Troubles were the Catholic versus Protestant sectarian violence that separated North from South. It separated neighborhoods in Northern Ireland's capital, Belfast, on religious lines. It separated families. The Troubles were deadly, with incidents of terrorism on both sides of the equation. Later in that spring of 1998, voters in the Republic of Ireland and in Northern Ireland both passed the agreement, paving the way for a new Ireland. The road has been rocky from time to time, and old grievances don't disappear overnight. But it has given hope for a new generation in Ireland's 26 counties and the North's 6 counties. It's given them the opportunity for peace, partnership, and prosperity that they didn't have before. One can only hope and pray that the same comes someday in the Middle East for the people of Israel and the people of Palestine. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. It's time again for the view from Bowen Island with my guest, Jim Mullen. Jim Mullen is the president of Football Canada, general secretary of the International Federation of American Football, and the host of Crown Gridiron Nation on TSN. Bowen Island is a slice of paradise in Howe Sound, just a short ferry ride away from Horseshoe Bay in West Vancouver. I asked Jim about the big story in Canadian football last week, the sudden end of football at Simon Fraser University, Canada's only NCAA program. The Red Leafs had nowhere to play in 2024 after a decision by the Lone Star Conference in Division II. But many inside and outside SFU football are wondering, why not play one more season in 2023? That's exactly what a player asked athletic director Teresa Hansen at a private meeting.
We're trying to know why we can't play in 2023. Like, that's a big concern right now, because it doesn't seem like there's any real reason other than, like I said, save money, save face, business decision, whatever it may be. Just because there isn't anything for 2024 doesn't mean we can't have something now.
It's very difficult. The uncertainty is very tough. The uncertainty is very difficult for all. The decision to not play this year, we cannot go the next 5 months without saying anything. That's not fair to you as athletes.
So why don't we still
play? Did that report
on the
What was your initial reaction to SFU closing down the Red Leafs football program?
Well, I was stunned. And the reason I was stunned was that there was no consultation done with any of the stakeholders, the players, the coaches, the alumni, the BC Lions, the provincial sports organization, the BCPFA, or Football Canada, for that matter. Anyone who is involved in the football community or involved in that team were not consulted on this in the run-up to it. So that was my initial shock when I caught wind of this from a couple of reliable sources on Sunday night. My mind immediately shifts to the athletes and where they're left right now at this particular point of the calendar. All teams out there, whether they're U Sports teams, Division II, Division I teams, they've all done their recruiting. They've all apportioned out their scholarship money. So, you know, is Simon Fraser going to continue that scholarship money if they switch to another school? You know, that's a question right now that is certainly unanswered. It's really unfortunate that the administration could be so thoughtless to just leave these athletes in a lurch like this. And then I got to thinking about the last team that dropped out of competition in the Great Northwest Conference a couple of years back, Humboldt State in Northern California. They had an announcement around this time, right after fiscal, that they would be dropping the football program. They gave the alumni an opportunity to rally around the program. They couldn't put something sustainable together, but they played out the season. And with a few games left in the season, the university made the final announcement that football would not be coming back. That's the suitable scenario here. There's a schedule in the Lone Star Conference that Simon Fraser can lock into and still play one more year. It can buy time for the alumni and other third-party interests to work with the university and work with other stakeholders as well. There's all kinds of opportunity to sustain football. But because this course was taken, I have to come to the conclusion that Teresa Hansen, the athletic director at Simon Fraser, simply just didn't want football. And as much as the press release went out saying that it wasn't about money, well, you have to be kidding me, right? But this announcement was made a day and a half into the start of a new fiscal year. So it's not about money? Okay, if it's not about money, then we'll judge you by all these other things across the board. And judging them based on consultation, judging them based on how they've treated their student athletes, judging them based on how they've treated their donors and their alumni, they fail on all accounts. They got a 0.0 GPA in terms of treating people well.
What role can Football Canada play to help rally others around in the football community far and wide to find a solution to reverse this decision? What is Football Canada doing?
Well, we can start a dialogue with stakeholders in Canada, first of all. We can have discussions with Canada West, for example, where SFU football was through 2009. We can have that discussion with U Sports, because U Sports is an associate member of Football Canada. So we have that dialogue there, and we have board members that are tied into both of those structures. We have had casual conversations this week as this came down with various stakeholders of both of those groups. And so my understanding right now from where we are at on this timeline is that there is an opportunity for Simon Fraser to engage Canada West. There is an opportunity for them to engage U Sports with more than just a phone call a week away from an announcement. If there's a thoughtful engagement, a plan, a process, submitting an application into both of these organizations, seeking an exemption from the NCAA policy that U Sports currently has. They are open to exploring this, as opposed to the spin that was coming out of Simon Fraser saying that U Sports simply said, no, that's not the case.
But what does this mean for one of Canada's top universities with such a great history in football to shut it down? What does this mean for the football community?
Well, I'm going to start from a very high level here, because 2 weeks ago I was in London, England. I'm on the board of IFAF, which is the international organization responsible for American football. And we had some very encouraging discussions there about creating a path for flag football to get to the LA 2028 games. And that's something that we're working diligently on and we feel very positive about. The reason I mention that is that in regard to Football Canada registration numbers, we're on track to match our numbers from 2016. We're on a sharp upward trend. One of those reasons is because of flag football. It allows kids to engage in the game at a younger age and become part of the sport, develop skills in the sport, to then make a decision as they get older whether or not they want to play tackle, flag, or both. The reason I bring all of that up is that we're in a process of changing the culture around the game. And, you know, right now, Simon Fraser is an unfortunate casualty of a series of bad decisions made at that level. I know some of the buzz around university football is that it doesn't comply to Title IX. We don't have Title IX in Canada, but certainly they have it in the United States, where athletic programs need an equal number of female competitors to an equal number of male competitors. Flag football helps us get there. And that's something that, quite frankly, Simon Fraser hasn't perceived in this move. Football Canada, in fact, is getting ready to stage its second national collegiate final this May with all women's teams from different universities across this country. So there's lots of expansion on the flag side. As for Simon Fraser, the university program shutting down, my attitude on this is that there's 27 other teams across this country playing university football. And as much as they're competitive, it's like NATO. You attack one, you attack all 27. So in terms of Football Canada, we're standing by Simon Fraser and their football program in this case to try to find a way to make sure they play in 2023 and try to be a part of that dialogue to get them back into Canadian competition in 2024, so we don't have to contemplate a loss of 100 to 125 spots for young men to play football.
In recent years, concern by some parents about their children playing football and the potential for head injuries. There have been a lot of moves within the football rules to try to make football a safer game, less contact in practices, for instance, removing risks to players in that way. Football Canada handling that and trying to make the game safer, not just by going for flag, but what is it doing in other aspects to make it safer, more appealing for parents to put their children into?
Well, this may sound a little dry, but we're revisiting our long-term athlete development plan. Every sport has one that has a NSO in this country. And our old plan that was originally formulated back in 2009 focused on tackle development. And the plan that we're working on right now kind of takes a hybrid of football skills, basketball, and volleyball, and puts it all into one place so we can have a focus on flag development. Because we know that the trend is that players will start tackle football at a later age. We see the research that is done on when you start football and how you leave yourself open to injuries at certain ages. So we want players to make that decision and their families to make that decision at a later age for full tackle football. But we want to engage them through flag football as a gateway. And with flag football, it's fantastic because you can engage kids as early as the age of 4 or 5, just as an activity, a non-structured activity, as you play up through the system. So making sure that we have a development strategy that focuses on a skill set, and also one of the things that we have to take care of, like every NSO has to take care of right now, that's certainly front and center with us, is an abuse-free sports culture within our sport. You've obviously seen the headlines with Hockey Canada, with Gymnastics Canada. We don't have those problems right now, so we think, but we're trying to get ahead of the curve on that. And that's something that's been really front and center with our board now for about the last 6 months as several government policies and edicts and communication comes down in terms of sport integrity. So those are some of the things that we're working on at Football Canada to make sure that we have an abuse-free space for kids to play in, and we have something that's physically safe for younger ages so that when their skills finally catch up and their size adjusts to the proper size, because we all know when you're around 12, 13, or 14, kids come in all different types of sizes. As kids get older, then they can graduate into the tackle game if they so choose.
And not only SFU got a stadium on Burnaby Mountain, but you also have a new, very motivated owner of the BC Lions who wants to include football in all its types, especially SFU, and give it greater attention. The timing couldn't be worse in so many ways.
I'd have to agree with you on that. I don't know what university takes $10 million from their students, invests another $20 million in a stadium, and then 3 to 4 years later finds a way to boot the football team out of it. It leaves me speechless to see some of the decisions that have been made at Simon Fraser. In addition to that, there was an additional $1.2 million, I think, put into dressing rooms for football teams up there that are now not going to be used. Really state of the art. It's very perplexing, to say the least. I do believe that this decision about the football team has actually been in the works for a while. When the Lone Star Conference said that there would be no 2024 season for Simon Fraser, this accelerated the process a fair bit. And I think when the administration looked at the potential for the 2023 season, they probably saw a pretty rough road ahead within the Lone Star Conference. A conference, by the way, that is commonly regarded as either the number one or number two Division II conference in the NCAA. It's a very competitive conference through Texas and New Mexico. I think they saw they could get through the season, but at the end of the season, Amar Doman was planning something pretty special for the next edition of the Shrum Bowl. There had been a rumor out there that it was coming to BC Place. So what would it look like for Simon Fraser if they were killing the football program and they were closing it out with 5,000, 7,000, 9,000, 14,000 people at BC Place Stadium watching a college football game? It would not reflect well on the school, and it would not reflect well on their decision. So I think that's one of the reasons they jumped the gun and killed the 2023 season.
And while I got you, I wanted to ask you about some other sports headlines this week, local and otherwise. The Vancouver Canadiens sold to a U.S. minor league baseball company, Diamond Baseball Holdings. What do you think about this transaction?
Well, this is kind of a minor league baseball Inc. type of deal with this company that runs several minor league baseball clubs coming in to own the team. First of all, when it comes to Mooney and Kerr, they've earned this moment in terms of the type of investment that they put in the baseball in this community, in terms of how they've taken essentially an ancient baseball stadium and done their utmost to modernize it, adding the seats out in left field. They've done a fantastic job there. I hope that hometown touch isn't lost with this team now that there's a corporate owner that knows how to squeeze profits out of various minor league baseball clubs. You just talked about Amar Doman. with the BC Lions. One of the reasons the Lions have turned around is because of local ownership. We talked about that for years with the Lions and David Braley. As much as Braley dug into his pockets, he did not have his finger on the pulse of people in BC and the Lower Mainland. I really hope that the management of the Canadians has that good line of communication to the head office that allows a seamless transition for this team as they go through this ownership change.
The WWE after WrestleMania is going to merge with the UFC. The sports that people thought were fads, especially from the 80s, 90s, wrestling, and in the 2000s, MMA in its most commercial, are now becoming one under one company. What do you think will happen to both sports?
Hey, Bob, are they getting married in Vegas?
That's the idea.
Because that's where they should sign off on this thing. They're both ring sports. They're both driven by big personalities. Some would even suggest that the results in UFC are somewhat engineered. We're crossing into an era right now where WWE was looking for a path, and they're still looking for a path to be picked up by sports betting books. And, you know, we all know the stories and the narratives around professional wrestling. But I guess if you can bet on outcomes of TV shows, you should be able to bet on professional wrestling results. There's a lot of harmony there, a lot of synergy. Just as we're talking about a company that owns numerous minor league baseball teams, there's an efficiency to it. There's a way to push a lot of these things through central office to rationalize costs. It would seem to me that this is a great decision on their part, and the type of secondary content that they can generate through this is probably exponential. So as much as I stopped watching wrestling about 20 years ago and I never watched the UFC, I've given it a shot, but I never watch it. Good on them for putting this together. I think it could be a very smart business move.
And speaking of wrestling and being in the ring, I understand there's a lot of action happening on Bowen Island around the development of a park.
Well, I want you to get on this story, Bob, because I think it has everything that a West Coast story requires. It's got the environment, it's got protesters, it's got a polarized community, it's got people advocating for it that are fading CanCon music stars. It's got small town city hall machinations. It's got terrible governance. It's got a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and then it's got campers that smell like patchouli coming in on a ferry that is always running late during the summertime, where there's always a one sailing wait now, where there never used to be one before, and there's absolutely no plan or study behind it. People need to dig into this story a little more. I think I've done a good job of headlining it and framing it. Just dig into this thing and try to go discover it on Facebook with some of the Bowen Island chat groups there. It's another one of those Facebook World War III's within the community right now that is really dividing this community into a pro park or anti park. There's very few people in between. And, you know, when I take a look at a UNESCO World Heritage site and I take a look at the potential for ferry traffic with 100 camping spots in a community of only 4,200, we got a narrow road that goes through the trunk of the island here. Unless you're willing to address the transportation issues that are going to accompany this, this is going to be a disaster. The other part is, I don't know why, outside of the purchase of the land, of course, it was originally, that's the other part that's missing from this. We had offshore investors on the original parcel of land that were going to build mansions. There you go. It's a total West Coast story, Bob. I don't know why this is a Metro Vancouver park, to tell you the truth, given where it's located, given the status of it. This is something that should really be tagged for a provincial park in the long term. We already have a Metro Vancouver park here that serves us quite well. I want you to advance this story, though, because it's got everything. It's interesting with Metro Vancouver. It's quasi-democratic in this area, in this era where we're defending democracy. I know that the first layer of these people are elected, and then they're appointed, and then they can run around Burnaby and just kind of craft things out of the line of sight right now. You know, I'm not a big fan of megacities, but I am a big fan of democracy. And a regional district like this, with this much importance within planning and infrastructure, should be directly accountable to the voters, not separated by a layer in this case.
And anything else happening on Bowie Island, in Howe Sound, that people need to know about these days as springtime starts anew?
It's sleepy and it's cold, and the garden is growing slowly. That's the type of news that Bowen Island should be producing right now. Very little news. Talk about the garden. That's about it. I wish we had video on here, because then I could turn the camera around and point it to my garden. That's all the news that you need to know out of Bowen Island, other than, let me see, the municipal works yard is complaining about their lunchroom. Because there's rats running around in it, and they want a $4 million replacement for it. Taxes are up on Bowen Island, but I guess that's about all the news that you need to know here.
A lot of things in common with the mainland, where there's too many rats and taxes are up everywhere. Thanks again for joining us on the Breaker.News podcast. Jim Mullen joining us with the occasional view from Bowen Island.
Thanks, Bob.
It's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In the Taiwan news, Taiwan president returns from trip to U.S., Guatemala, Belize. Journey shows Taiwan will not abandon international contacts under pressure. President Tsai Ing-wen arrived home April 7th from a 10-day trip, which included a historic meeting with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy in the U.S. and visits to allies Guatemala and Belize. The U.S. has been a popular destination for Taiwanese politicians, with Foxconn technology founder and presidential hopeful Terry Gu wrapping up an 8-day tour, and another presidential contender, former Taipei City Mayor Ko Wen-je, embarking on a 3-week trip. Meanwhile, for the first time since 1979, a delegation from the U.S. House Foreign Affairs Committee visited Taiwan's legislature on April 7th. In Kyoto news, Japan plans to lead talks on AI risks at a G7 digital meeting. The push comes as the AI revolution, including chatbots like ChatGPT, has brought with it a range of concerns, such as the unauthorized collection of personal data and its impact on learning environments. In the Hong Kong Free Press, punishing Hong Kong Ice Hockey Association over anthem blunder would be unreasonable, says player. The row over the anthem distracted attention from the good result achieved by the Hong Kong ice hockey team and the personal sacrifices made by players, said one of them. The Sports Federation and Olympic Committee of Hong Kong, China, threatened on Monday to suspend the association after an incident in which Glory to Hong Kong, a song composed during the protests in 2019, was played at a February match in Bosnia and Herzegovina instead of the Chinese national anthem, March of the Volunteers. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, Oregon's recent growth in homelessness among largest in nation. The number of people experiencing homelessness in Oregon grew nearly 23% between 2020 and 2022, increasing by 3,300 people to about 18,000, according to a federally mandated homeless count. Washington experienced a 10% hike and California 6%. Across the United States, there were more than 582,000 people experiencing homelessness in early 2022. In the Seattle Times, Port of Seattle nearly lost $570,000 to phishing emails, prompting audit. The two phishing incidents occurred in October and December 2021, resulting in almost $573,000 in public funds being transferred to fraudulent bank accounts over a series of 8 payments. In both incidents, the Port's Office of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion forwarded phishing emails to the Port's accounts payable department or another employee for processing. The Port was able to recover all but $50,000 of the lost funds, with $356,000 coming from the bank and $166,000 from crime insurance coverage. In the Times Colonist, former Ukrainian pastor arrested in arson attack on family home of Ukrainian priest in Victoria last spring. Police said the arson was a targeted offense, but was not a hate crime. Father Yuri Vishnevsky and his family narrowly escaped the fire in their home next door to St. Nicholas the Wonder Worker at Caledonia Avenue and Cook Street in the early hours of April 20, 2022. Victoria Police Major Crime Detectives arrested Walter Theo Mashinsky, 60, of Nanaimo. He is charged with one count of arson with disregard for human life. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to religious communities who are housing the homeless and supporting seniors and children living in poverty. Easter coincides with Passover and Ramadan, so special mention to British Columbia Christians, Jews, and Muslims. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 9th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 9th of April in 2023, 20 years ago, Baghdad fell to the Americans during the Iraq War? Economist Joseph Stiglitz estimated the war cost the U.S. economy $3 trillion. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Happy Easter. Until next week.